Well met, and welcome to episode 40 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 11th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to continue our month-long discussion of A Midsummer Night's Dream. We'll finish up our plot synopsis of the play, then begin reviews of the productions available on DVD starting this week with the 1981 BBC Collected Works version. Then we'll finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. When we left off last week at the end of Act 3, Scene 1, the lovers were in the woods. Puck had mistakenly put the love potion on Lysander's eyes, and now he's in love with Helena. Bottom has been transformed with an ass's head, and Titania is now in love with him. Act 3, Scene 2, at 463 lines, is the longest in the play, longer than any other act in the play, including the single scene 420 line Act 5. It begins with Oberon musing if Titania has yet awakened, we know that she has, and then questioning the newly arrived Puck as to how his errands have gone. Puck recounts with great enthusiasm how Titania now, with a monster, is in love, going into great detail about Bottom's rehearsal transformation. Oberon is thrilled. This falls out better than I could devise, and asks how the Athenian mission went. Puck answers in the affirmative, and when Demetrius and Hermia enters, Oberon orders, "Stand close. This is the same Athenian." To which Puck can only respond, "This is the woman, but this not the man." Uh-oh. Demetrius wants to know why Hermia still rebukes him. Hermia seems less rebuking than fearful for the life of Lysander, implying that Demetrius may have killed him. Demetrius denies the crime. Hermia has nothing else to do with Demetrius if he cannot tell her where Lysander is, and so she leaves. Demetrius realizes that there is no following her in this fierce vein, and so he decides to rest. He lies down and goes to sleep. Oberon is not a happy camper over this, but Puck says that fate overrules. It's not his fault, it was meant to be. Oberon gives Puck a new job, find Helena and bring her here, while Oberon uses the love juice to charm Demetrius's eyes in anticipation of her arrival. Within moments, Puck is back, just ahead of Helena and Lysander, remarking, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." Lysander arrives, asking Helena why she thinks he is being so scornful to her when he is really in love with her. She cannot believe him or his words. "These vows are Hermia's. Will you give her o'er? Weigh oath with oath, and you will nothing weigh. Your vows to her and me, put in two scales, will even weigh, and both are as light as tales." Lysander says, "I had no judgment when to her I swore." And Helena responds, "Nor none in my mind now that you give her o'er." She sees clearly that either his vows to Hermia are meaningless, nothing weigh, or his new ones to her are, or both. When Lysander says that he had no judgment when he was in love with Hermia, Helena says that she thinks that he has none now either in abandoning her. At this point, Helena's thinking is pretty clear. Lysander then accounts what they both do know. Demetrius loves Hermia, and he loves not Helena. But before Helena can respond to those words wake Demetrius, who sees Helena and, as according to Oberon's plan, falls in love with Helen, goddess, nymph, perfect, divine. "O spite, O hell," Helena exclaims, "I see you are all bent to set against me for your merriment." And who can blame her? First, she has no lover, then she has two that had both been in love with Hermia, whose beauty had earlier made Helena feel as ugly as a bear. And despite the fact that this is what she had wanted, Demetrius's love, it's all incredible, and she doesn't believe it. Both Demetrius and Lysander both try to give their former love of Hermia to the other while keeping Helena for his own. Helena is not amused, and the amusement doesn't grow with the arrival of Hermia. When she asks Lysander why he left her side, he says that the hate he bears her made him leave. Hermia perceptively notes, "You speak not as you think it cannot be. After all, it's just not conceivable that this change came about." But as Hermia basically says that it's impossible for her lover to love Helena, Helena has had enough. Lo, she is one of this confederacy. And what follows is an explosion of anger and a feeling of betrayal from Helena, one that leaves Hermia amazed at Helena's passionate words. As Helena begins to verbally attack Hermia, Lysander and Demetrius are spoiling for a fight. The female insults begin to fly, mainly on a physical level, It would seem that Hermia is short of stature, or at least shorter than Helena. As Hermia puts it, "Now I perceive that she hath made compare between our statures. She hath urged her height, and with her personage, her tall personage, her height, forsooth, she hath prevailed with him. And are you grown so high in his esteem because I am so dwarfish and so low? How low am I, thou painted maypole, speak! How low am I? I am not yet so low that my nails can reach unto thine eyes." Oh, you gotta love that. I particularly like the maypole image, tall and skinny like a pole, painted as in heavily made up to hide imperfections, and an intimation of wantonness, as the maypole dances were usually fertility rites, and the maypole itself a rather large, rather obvious phallic symbol. Now, the men must interrupt their physical posturing to keep the little but fierce acorn from attacking their taller love. But when Demetrius again challenges Lysander, they head off to fight, while Helena uses her physical attributes to escape Hermia. Her legs are longer to run away. With the mortals gone, Oberon takes stock of the situation and blames it all on Puck. "This is thy negligence. Still thou mistakest, or else commit'st thy knaveries willfully." While Puck denies responsibility, "I mistook." He can't help but to admit that he is enjoying all this. "And so far am I to see it so did sort, as this their jangling I esteem a sport." Oberon then tells Puck to run the boys around until they collapse from fatigue, then crush this herb unto Lysander's eyes, whose liquor hath this virtuous property, to take from thence all error with his might, and make his eyeballs roll with wonted sight. Oberon says that this will seem a dream to the men. In the meantime, Oberon will release his queen, and all things shall be peace. And the rest of the act is just watching Puck do his duty, causing all the lovers in the fog of love to tire and sleep near each other, all in readiness for Act 4. Act 4, Scene 1, begins with Titania and Bottom, ass head and all, plus her fairies attending on him. More interestingly, however, is the stage direction of the King Oberon behind them. In other words, Oberon watches the first part of this scene unseen. Titania dotes wonderfully on Bottom. "Come, sit thee down on this flowery bed, while I thy amiable cheeks do coy, and stick musk roses in thy sleek smooth head, and kiss thy fair large ears, my gentle joy." Love is blind in ABAB rhyme. Kind of rhyme there myself. Anyway, she finds beauty in his sleek, smooth head and large ears as she caresses, coy, his lovable, amiable cheeks. This is as pure a vision of love and joy, gentle joy no less, in the entire play. Unlike Theseus's formal declarations and the lover's rushed, seemingly far too passionate speeches, this is love, calm and soothing, rather than political or lustful. And if Titania finds joy in doting on Bottom, he enjoys it no less, interacting with the fairies with the greatest of ease, letting slip the occasional realization of his changed self. "Methinks I am marvelous Harry. I am such a tender ass. I could munch your good dry oats, a bottle of hay." Now, does Bottom realize his shape? Does he see himself for what he is? Has he seen himself? Or has he internalized his outward shape without consciously witnessing it? These are all interesting questions and all perfect for performance. Titania sends the fairies away and tells her lover, "Sleep thou, and I will wind thee in my arms. Oh, how I love thee, how I dote on thee." When they sleep, Oberon advances and Puck arrives. While Oberon finds this scene a sweet sight, he also pities this hateful imperfection of her eyes. He tells Puck that he has asked Titania for and received the changeling boy and will now undo the trick. He then asks Puck to remove the ass head from Bottom. When Titania awakes, she thinks she has been enamored of an ass, and when Oberon points out Bottom, she loathes his visage now. Love may be blind, but fear and loathing, that's 2020. As the lovers and now an ass-headless Bottom continue to sleep, the king and queen of the fairies dance a dance of reconciliation. Morning comes, the fairies depart, and Theseus and a hunting party, including Hippolyta and Aegeus, arrive. After the not-quite-weds wax poetic on the sounds of Theseus's hounds, we begin to see the martial experiences that Theseus and Hippolyta have in common. Maybe those martial commonalities will turn into marital happiness after all. Theseus finds the four lovers asleep on the ground and says, "No doubt they rose up early to observe the rites of May." observe the rites of May. That would mean drinking, feasting, and dancing, right? Or as my bawdy high school English teacher once said, hooray, hooray, the 1st of May, outdoor humping starts today. And that was the clean version. It almost seems that Theseus realizes what he's said and to whom he's said it and backtracks with, and hearing our intent, came here to grace our solemnity. Yeah, right. There's a funny moment when Theseus orders his huntsmen to wake the lovers with their horns. Then Theseus begins to question the lovers. It's like the 3 a.m. question. You have to tell the truth because you're not awake enough to lie. And Lysander admits coming to the woods with Hermia, beyond the reach of the Athenian law. With this, Aegeus has heard enough and wants Lysander punished, telling Demetrius that Lysander has robbed him of a wife. When Demetrius responds, however, it is a Demetrius unlike the one we've seen all play. He's neither the wooer of Hermia nor the over-the-top relentless pursuer of Helena. Now he simply wishes Helena, loves her, longs for her, and will forevermore be true to Helena. Of course, he's still under the spell of the love juice. But before Aegeus can speak and upset this equilibrium, Theseus overbears Aegeus's will and announces that the two couples will be wed side by side with Theseus and Hippolyta later that day. Theseus and his hunting party then leave, and Bottom, too, awakes. Unlike the lovers who can't figure out what was real and what was a dream, Bottom is certain. He has had a dream, past the wit of man, to say what dream it was. Of course, he hasn't. It's been real in the play. Or has it? Could all of this be Bottom's dream, dreamt in Midsummer? He decides that he must have Peter Quince write a ballad of the dream, one that he can sing at the latter end of their play, before the Duke. He is returned to his normal senses as the center of attention. Act 4, Scene 2 finds us back at Quince's house, where the actors are in a bad state. They have a play, but no star, until Bottom arrives with news that their play is preferred and has made the final slate of entertainments. He cautions his fellows to eat no onions nor garlic, for they are to utter sweet breath. And off they go to fame and fortune, or at least sixpence, and with any luck, to be made men. Act 5, Scene 1, the only scene of the last act, begins in Duke Theseus's palace. Theseus and his new bride Hippolyta arrive with Philostrate. Hippolyta notes that, 'tis strange, my Theseus, what these lovers speak of. Theseus is dismissive. More strange than true. I may never believe these antique fables nor these fairy toys. Theseus, the warrior king, has no time for tales of fairies. Ironic that Oberon claims that Titania once had love to Theseus, no? The lunatic, the lover, and the poet, Theseus proclaims, are of imagination all compact, in other words, without reason. As a man of action, not of imagination, it is easy for him to have this opinion. Hippolyta, however, questions this argument, noting that all the lovers had the same story. So could it be real? Now, before the newlyweds can go any further into this philosophical discourse on imagination, enter the newly married lovers, and Theseus calls for the entertainment. Philostrate reads over some of the possible choices, but none of them seem right for the occasion. A song sung by a eunuch, the tale of Orpheus being killed by the Bacchanals, the muses mourning the death of learning. On the other hand, there is a tedious brief scene of young Pyramus and his love Thisbe, very tragical mirth. The oxymorons, tedious brief and tragical mirth, grab the Duke's attention, and he begs Philostrate to tell him more about the play. Philostrate outlines the reasons behind the oxymorons. The scene only has 10 speeches, but feels too long. It's supposed to be sad, but more merry tears the passion of loud laughter never shed. Theseus is dying to hear it, but Philostrate tries to steer him away from the choice, citing its poor quality. Theseus will not be denied, however, saying that if it is bad, it is the noble's job to act as if it was well done. This classy philosophy will be sorely tested, however. Quince enters to deliver the prologue, and we can see immediately what Philostrate was warning the Duke about. If we offend, it is with our good will, that you should think we come not to offend, but with good will, to show our simple skill. That is the true beginning of our end. Wow, that's awful. But pretty damn funny. And the play begins, punctuated at times with commentary from the newlyweds, though interestingly enough, mostly by the males, and none whatsoever from either Helena or Hermia. None of the criticism reaches the level of cruelty of the audience participation from Love's Labour's Lost, but there is some mocking nevertheless. The prologue, Quince, outlines the action to follow. The wall, Snout, comes in to introduce himself and to hold up his fingers as the chink through which the lovers will speak. Pyramus, Bottom, arrives to declaim his love from one side of the wall. Thisbe, Flute, then arrives to do the same from the other. The lovers decide to meet at Ninny's tomb, a mangling of Ninus's tomb, and the lovers and wall exit. On come Lion, Snug, and Moonshine, Starveling, to deliver their expository lines. Thisbe enters. Lion roars. Thisbe runs off. Lion mouths Thisbe's scarf, then exits. Pyramus enters, finds Thisbe's bloody scarf, thinks the worst, and kills himself, after much discussion. I've always thought this was kind of a comic predecessor of Hamlet's tragical final words. I die, Horatio. Thisbe returns, finds her lover dead, and kills herself. End of play. The play is a mess, poorly written, clumsily delivered, and certainly not befitting a duke. But if played right, it really should be, in Hippolyta's words, the silliest stuff that ever I heard. There is the offer of an epilogue, Bottom's Dream, perhaps, that is respectfully declined because the duke has better ideas. Sweet friends, to bed. A fortnight hold we this solemnity in nightly revels and new jollity. And the mortals all leave the stage. The fairies return for one last moment to bless the bride-bed and to ensure that the issue there create ever shall be fortunate. Off go the fairies to leave Puck to deliver the final speech of the play, directly to the audience. If we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear. And then finally, give me your hands if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends. And we, as an audience, give Puck our hands in applause, and the play is over. Okay, there's a boatload of DVD versions of A Midsummer Night's Dream out there, so let's start to take a look at them this week. Let's start, as we always do, with the BBC Collected Works production. This presentation from the BBC Collected Works of Shakespeare series came about midway through the series, taped in May of 1981. This production was directed by Elijah Moshinsky, who also did The Love's Labour's Lost from a couple of months back, a production that I ultimately told listeners to skip as I felt it was a little too serious, a little too formal. And for the opening moments of this production, I was worried that we were heading in the same direction. In the early scenes at the Duke's Palace, everything is very static. Characters seated, little or no movement, either by the characters or the camera. Nigel Davenport's Theseus is an aged warrior, while Estelle Kohler's Hippolyta is obviously one in captivity. The characters are as stiff as the collars of the main characters, who seem to have been plucked from a painting by Rembrandt. But once we're out of the palace and into Quint's home, and then later, and better, into the woods, the play comes alive. The introduction of the fairy world comes fast and furious, almost too rushed, until Puck's speech comes as a voiceover and the camera and action slow down. The fairies are children with wings, though Titania's attendants are wingless children, and Oberon's followers are male and adult, and it makes for an interesting contrast. Moshinsky directs Nicky Henson as Demetrius to be a very forward wooer of Hermia. He really seems to dislike Helena through much of the play, which tends to make the pairing off in Act 4 a tad bit sudden. The female lovers are both solid. Pippa Gard plays Hermia as a fairly innocent girl. Cherith Mellor's Helena is gawky, but a more worldly wise. Puck, Phil Daniels, in this presentation, is much more the knavish sprite than the merry wanderer of the night. There's a cruel and physical edge to his mischief. His teeth, filed to sharpened fangs, only make this more obvious. And this physicality is perfect coming from a follower of this particular Oberon, as played by Peter McHenry, a shirtless, macho, strutting rock star of a fairy. It's a shame that Hippolyta's role is so small. Kohler's performance has that neat balance of power and femininity, of force and thought. It would have been nice to see more of her exotic take on the role. The role of Philostrate was played by Hugh Quarshie, and if that name is familiar to you, you must be a longtime listener. He would later play Aaron in the Collected Works production of Titus Andronicus. Now, Philostrate is a pretty small role here, so he must have impressed producers enough to give him that much meatier role a couple of years later. Brian Glover makes for a wonderfully big, loud, bald Bottom. His scratching scene with the fairies borders on the orgasmic for the character, so when he instantly wants to sleep, pretty funny moment. Now, for those of you who have seen this production, you know I've been avoiding one performance, but I'm just saving the best for last. Titania is played by Helen Mirren. She was 38 when she made this, and frankly, she looks pretty much like she does now. She has aged wonderfully, and she is hot in this. The gauzy dresses she wears, yeah, makes you want to be bottom for a night. When Oberon wakes her from her trance, he kisses the antidote flower and then kisses her eyelids. It's a wonderfully tender moment for such a macho king of fairies. Her waking, then her silent realization of her dream, and then her giggle over what she thinks was a dream, is a marvel of subtlety and facial acting. Then, when she gets a chance to see bottom, her reaction is visceral, truly wonderful. And then when Oberon and Titania reconcile, their embrace and kiss are remarkably sexy for a BBC production. The final play within a play is marvelous, and while not knockabout slapstick and wild, it's funny nevertheless. It's a solid production. Moschinsky chooses to cut the final two lines of the play where Puck asks for our hands, but that's fine, it fits better with a live audience. It's a solid production. Makes me more interested in his other plays in the series, Cymbeline, Coriolanus, and All's Well. Like I said, this is a solid production. Accessible, good performances, and, well, you know, Helen Mirren. It's highly recommended and available from both Netflix and Amazon.com. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Act 3, changes, Act 4, a return to normalcy, Act 5, that's entertainment, sources, or lack thereof, What's in a Name, Part 1, the Athenians, What's in a Name, Part 2, the Actors. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes, you know, like Nicholas Sparks trashing Shakespeare, what a tool, than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for April the 11th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.